This is session number 4 of Revelation Road Trip. This session will be covering the introduction to the letter to the seven churches of Asia, and this is found in Revelation chapter 1, verses 9 through 20. Once again, I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. I, John, your brother and partner in the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance that are in Jesus, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus and to Smyrna and to Pergamum and to Thyatira and to Sardis and to Philadelphia and to Laodicea. Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined in a furnace, and his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp, two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. Write, therefore, the things that you have seen, those that are and those that are to take place after this. As for the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. So there we have it. This is the introduction to kind of like the first act of the drama. The first act of the drama that is going to take place, the letter to the seven churches. Already we're seeing some interesting imagery, some strange imagery. And once again, as we read and as we hear these words, we are called to imagine in our mind's eye what John saw in his vision. So as I read these words, what are some of the impressions that I take away? Some of my initial impressions. John apparently is probably in exile on the island of Patmos. There's a very dramatic call on John to write, you know, this vision. From what I imagine, John was simply kind of minding his own business on this particular day, which he calls the Lord's Day. However, at the same time, he was apparently sensing some particular closeness to God on this day. He was in the Spirit. And as he's perhaps worshiping, perhaps meditating, perhaps just thinking about God and thinking about Jesus Christ, he is startled out of his senses, or maybe startled into his senses, is more appropriate for Revelation, by a loud announcement. And all of a sudden, he's not only hearing things, but he is seeing things. It's a visual communication from God to John, and which is interpreted by John into his own words. Obviously, there's an auditory portion, because it began that way. So a vision includes both pictures and sound. John spins around to see who is behind him, who is speaking to him with such a loud voice, the sound of a trumpet-like voice. And John visualizes a scene from somewhat unusual to completely bizarre. The visuals are somewhat exaggerated and a little extreme, you might say. First, there seems to be these large golden lampstands, 7 of them, among which a being, looks like a human being, is walking amongst. This being is familiar, seems familiar to John. John describes him as Son of Man. Yet, even in its familiarity, this being has some bizarreness to it. The long robe and the golden sash and the belt, white hair, perhaps fairly standard, although someone having white hair whose whiteness is like wool, like that of snow, is certainly unusual. You know, there may be some people with, you know, pure white hair like that, but not too many. But then from there we go get into some more bizarre imagery. Eyes like flames of fire. You know, can you imagine that sort of thing? Eyes that are burning. And then feet that are glowing, like burnished bronze, refined in a furnace. 7 stars are being held in his right hand, and there is a 2-edged sword coming out of his mouth. His face is like the shining sun, glowing like a noonday sun at full strength. So John sees this, and his only response is to fall as though one dead at the feet of this being, the Son of Man. He probably imagines some kind of judgment is about to fall upon him. He probably feels like, you know, this is not a good thing that's about to happen to him. And at the same time, perhaps, you know, he's wondering, you know, what's going on here? Is this real or is this imagined? Certainly as a Jew, he was probably looking forward to, you know, the day of the Lord. As a Christian, he would be looking forward to the return of Christ, but this would be an unusual event in any case. So, John has fallen as though one dead at the feet of this being. The Son of Man's response to John's response, you know, the Son of Man is obviously a being of great power. But at the same time, as we've been discovering, is God's power, Christ's power, is over all of creation, yet at the same time, he comes close to every being. And that's what we see here, again, is the Son of Man takes his right hand, the one holding the stars, and lays it onto John, and says, "Fear not." Now, fear not, it's interesting because it is the most frequently given command in the Bible. Now, you might think there'd be all sorts of other commands or commandments that would be repeated more frequently, but throughout the Bible, fear not is the most frequently given command from either a divine being or an angelic being. So you might say that, in light of that, the message of the Bible is you don't have to fear God. You can trust him. You can rely on him. The description that the Son of Man gives to himself, the first and the last, died and alive, forevermore echoes back to the prologue section that we studied in the last session, such as, for example, the first and the last is similar to the phrase Alpha and Omega in verse 8. Died and alive, referring to the resurrection, can be referring back to the phrase firstborn of the dead in verse 5, and the phrase forevermore is, well, this idea of eternity that's also found in verse 6, in where the phrase there is glory and dominion forever. This being holds the keys of death and Hades. So this Son of Man is able to, it appears, to unlock mysteries, including the mystery of death. The Son of Man once again reiterates the command to John to write down the vision. So it is very, again, John is communicating to his audience that this is not his own invention, but that coming from God. And so the mystery begins to be revealed, as the last verse of chapter 1, verse 20 says, as for the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. So some of the mystery that was talked about, the signs that were promised to be revealed, begins to be revealed with verse 20. And another impression that I got while reading this section is the number 7. 7 appears to be an important number. Before we go into the actual text of this passage, let's go into some background information. First, we don't know for certain that John was exiled. That is certainly the tradition, and that is quite a likely possibility. And if John was indeed exiled to Patmos, then it was probably due to one of the local governors sending him there. The local governors had very wide discretion in handing down the type of sentence to the guilty. This is in the Roman Empire. So John would have been banished to Patmos either on account of his age, which would be a likely possibility, or simply because the governor felt a little merciful at that time. And banishment could be of two types. Deportatio, which only the emperor himself could declare. And in this case, property would be confiscated and civil rights would be lost. So a person involved in that sort of sentence presumably would end up more or less a slave. On the other hand, the type of banishment that John suffered was most likely relegatio, which did not include any of these additional penalties. It was simply banishment. And so John would have had fairly wide latitude and freedom on the island of Patmos. Patmos itself was not deserted. It was a community. It was a, must have been fairly decently sized because it included a gymnasium and a temple to Artemis. As far as visions, most commonly in the non-biblical apocalyptic literature, the writer who claims to have the vision invites them through various means, whether it's through fasting, through eating and drinking of certain substances, whatever it is, the writer would invite the visions. However, in John's case, the vision is unsolicited. And perhaps the point of that is that this is not something of John's own invention, but rather, again, it is something that was given by God. the seven churches to where this letters and the book of Revelation are to go are located, again, in a kind of a circle around the western portion of modern-day Turkey, about 30 to 45 miles apart, in order, in sequence. Again, going back to other apocalyptic works of that time, they employ similar imagery, although some of these works exaggerate considerably more than what is found in Revelation. For example, there is one apocalypse that mentions angels that are thousands of miles tall. Now, some Jewish texts describe angels shining as the sun, so the Son of Man's face shining like the noonday sun would not be at all unusual. And the image of a recipient of a vision falling in terror is certainly common in Jewish texts. Bizarre imagery is not uncommon. We find that in the Bible. Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, all prophetic books, contain some interesting and bizarre imagery. And some of the apocryphal books also include bizarre imagery, such as the Apocalypse of Abraham, the Apocalypse of Zephaniah, Second Book of Enoch, and the book Joseph and Asenath. So, a first century reader reading Revelation would not find the images in Revelation particularly disturbing or shocking. It would be like someone reading a fantasy novel, or a sci-fi novel, or watching either of those genres today. No, it would be like someone reading or someone watching the Lord of the Rings movie. There'd certainly be some bizarre creatures and images there, but it doesn't shock us. It would be the same way. So, John was using commonly understood language to attempt to communicate what he saw in his words. If John was living today, he would probably employ words and imagery that are familiar to, say, if he was writing to 21st century Americans, he would be using popular imagery from our time. So, he was doing something similar in the first century. As far as the keys, Jews understood keys to mean authority over that which it opens. So, and they understood gates of Hades as the realm of the dead. So whoever held the keys to the gates of Hades ruled over them. And Jewish literature did say God has the keys to Hades. So again, John is using phrases and words that are already familiar to the people, to his audience. Once again, I need to remind us that prophecy in the biblical sense is not primarily about prediction. It can include prediction, but it is first and foremost a message that is given from God. The Greeks, and Plutarch in particular, defined prophecy as prediction of future events caused by the present and the past. And in Jewish apocalyptic literature, they often divided history into ages as first a prelude to their prophecies about the future. So they would divide history into the previous age, perhaps, but more importantly, it would be divided into the present age and the age to come. Just to note that Jewish apocalyptic works were often pseudonymously written after the events took place. So the supposed predictions were written after they had taken place. Now, in the case of books like Daniel and Revelation, we hold that they were written prior to any future events. So there is a difference there between the prophetic books, the apocalyptic books found in the Bible versus those that are not. Jewish texts often portrays angels as stars, so the Son of Man holding the stars is certainly a familiar imagery. And cosmic imagery is very frequent. The Palestinian synagogues in the later times, later periods, sported the zodiac. Now, zodiac is associated with astrology, even though such associations and such things like the zodiac are forbidden in the Old Testament. Now, the synagogues came about during and after the Babylonian exile of the Jewish nation as a place for the Jews to receive instruction in the Torah. Now, what about the pagans? Pagans believed fate controlled nations through the stars, and stars were often deified. And this whole idea of astrology and mythology, this was considered their science. Now, the Jews, because they were a strictly monotheistic people, they would not deify the stars. But at the same time, all these ancient peoples had to attribute unknown forces to something. So the Jews concurred that stars controlled nations, but interpreted the stars not as deities or demigods, but rather as angels, messengers of God. So these angels held power over certain aspects of the universe and the world. Now, we noted earlier that Patmos had a temple of Artemis, and Artemis was a very popular and major goddess, one of the major deities of that region. An older name for Artemis was Hecate, and Hecate was known to hold the keys to Hades. Hecate was known to have three forms related to heaven, the earth, and the underworld. And the underworld is often described as the sea or the ocean. In these three forms, the first one associated with heaven would be Selene or Luna, meaning the moon goddess. On the earth, she was represented by Artemis or Diana. And in the underworld, her form was Persephone. Hecate was also known as the beginning and the end, and she moved freely between all three realms. Therefore, Hecate was known to be a goddess of revelation, one who was able to reveal the mysteries of heaven as well as the mysteries of the underworld to the people on the earth. She was a powerful goddess, a dominion over much of what was known in the universe. So, again, John appears to be using imagery and symbolism that is familiar, now this time to the Greeks and the Romans, saying this Christian God, Jesus Christ, is like Artemis, but greater. Going back to the Jewish religion, the Jewish lampstand contains seven branches. This is the menorah. It's the symbol for Judaism. And it's interesting that the Son of Man walks through the seven lampstands. Again, the interpretation could be that John is saying that the true inheritor of Judaism, the true Israel, is that which is represented by Christianity. The one who believes in Christ belongs to the true Israel. Going into one of the Greek literary forms, a Greek play had the basic structure of a prologue, a parados, or a parade, where the characters are introduced and enter into the theater, which is followed by multiple episodes, multiple acts. Each act is introduced, and then the act itself takes place. So this repeats. Depending on the type of play, there might be 3, 4, or 5, typically, episodes. And finally, the play ends with an exodus, where the characters exit. The book of Revelation itself appears to conform to such a structure. We've already examined the prologue. And in the prologue, the last part of it was the introduction of really the main character and the only character that really matters in this book, that of Jesus Christ. And now begins 7 acts in 7 scenes, each with an introduction that sets the scene, and then the details follow. And the first of these acts are the letters to the 7 churches. Following the letters, there will be 7 seals, the 7 trumpets, the final crisis, 7 bowls, the millennium, and the New Jerusalem. And Revelation ends with an epilogue. So once again, not only is John wanting this to be read aloud and to be heard, but he is formatting it as kind of a play, a drama, so that people are already familiar with the format and they can relate to it. They know what to expect. Finally, what are the angels of the churches found in verse 20? There are 4 views. It could mean that each of these angels are messengers bearing the scrolls to the churches. I mean, in other words, human messengers bearing the scrolls to the churches, which is, although possible, is unlikely because there was probably only 1 copy that was made, and it would be read in a circular fashion as the scroll went from one church to another. 3 other views that are more likely is that the first one, the angels could be the public readers at each church, the one who actually brings the message at each church to the servants of God, the congregation. The angels could be guardian angels of each church. Now, there was a view that each church had guardian angels, and that's what it could represent. And the 3rd possibility is that these angels represent heavenly counterparts to earthly realities, whatever that may be. And we don't really know. And suffice to say, we don't need to figure it out precisely what it is in order to read and to try to understand this book. So with that, we can now go into the text of our passage today. Verse 9 sets the scene, it's the setting. Begins with brother. Now this is John's relationship to his recipients. John is a fellow Christian. He doesn't provide any credentials as to who he is. No association with Jesus, no association with other apostles. He's simply a brother. Obviously, the recipients would know who he is. He doesn't feel a need to specify anything more other than a brother. And a partner, meaning a one who shares. One who shares in the tribulation, in the kingdom, and in the patient endurance. Important to note that John and the churches are experiencing it in the present time. Now, tribulation in Revelation is often thought of as something that's going to happen right before the end. But interpreting it together with the letters that are being sent, this first act, tribulation is something that is already happening and already being experienced. Same with the kingdom. The kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven, is not something that's off in the distant future, but it's already here. And the patient endurance that will be called for in a number of other places in Revelation is already being experienced at this time when John is writing. As far as this tribulation, Daniel, it's an allusion to Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, where Daniel describes a future time of trouble during which God's people will be delivered. And John is bringing that into the present time, saying that time is here. If John indeed was exiled and banished to Patmos, he may be seeing his banishment as a parallel to the Jewish exile that happened in Babylon. And so as a result, he now sees Rome as the new Babylon, and just as the Old Testament prophets denounced Babylon, John will denounce the new Babylon. In verses 10 and 11, John describes the voice. And this voice is heard while John is in the Spirit. This is probably most directly related to Ezekiel's experiences, which are found in Ezekiel chapter 2 and chapter 3. And also chapter 11 and 43. The first of those series there, Ezekiel 2 verse 2, reads, "And as he spoke to me, the Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet, and I heard him speaking to me." What John is describing here is probably some kind of a charismatic, spirit-filled experience, perhaps trance-like. And again, although we may consider that a little strange or weird, it was a fairly common experience, and we have examples of that in the New Testament as well, in Acts chapter 10, chapter 11, chapter 22, and 2 Corinthians chapter 12. In the Spirit is not necessarily a worship experience, although it may have been a part of worship. Now, John chapter 4, verse 23 contains words of Jesus where he says that in the future people will worship God in spirit and in truth. And although the phrasing is similar, we shouldn't base a conclusion that because they're similar, it was worship. Just because someone by the name of John wrote both of these books. We already discussed earlier that, in an earlier session, that the opinion on who wrote Revelation is divided. And so we should not be making definitive conclusions based simply upon a connection between the gospel account of John and Revelation. John had his vision here in Revelation on the Lord's Day. Well, you know, I suppose in most cases this shouldn't really raise any eyebrows, but you know, depending on which circle or groups of people you might be with, it may. And so the first thing to note is that this phrase, Lord's Day, is the only such reference in the New Testament. So again, to make any sort of conclusion based upon that fact would be misguided. So what day is it? Well, there are some options. We really don't know, and that's probably okay. Or it's the day of judgment. Certainly, judgment, again, is a recurring theme in the book of Revelation. And I'm sure John felt as he fell as one dead before the Son of Man, that this may have been the day of judgment or the day of the Lord, as it is commonly known in Jewish writings. This could have been Easter. Certainly, you know, Easter could have been an important day that would have been called the Lord's Day. Or the Lord's Day could have meant a day of the emperor, of the emperor of Rome. In which, if that was the case, then for John to be having these revelation of the supreme ruler of the universe on a day in which the Roman emperor was being honored would be ironic. The Lord's Day might be Saturday, because certainly that would have been the Jewish day of gathering at synagogues, and the Jews would have called God Lord. And there is no explicit command to worship on any other day in the New Testament writings. But to argue against the Lord's Day being Saturday, you know, by this time the Jews and the Christians were not getting along together. The Christians had been expelled from the synagogues. So, you know, back up. The early Christians, so ignore what I just said. I'll be getting to that in just a little while. So, with the Jewish animosity that had been developing, and they were certainly, the Christians were expelled from the synagogue, instead of calling Saturday the Sabbath, the early Christians may have found it preferable to call Sabbath by another day, such as the Lord's Day. However, the case is pretty strong that the Lord's Day referred to Sunday. The writing Didache, chapter 14, verse 1, Didache was written contemporary with or earlier than Revelation, perhaps as early as 50, the year 50, and Revelation, we are going under the assumption that it was written in the 90s, between 90 and 96. So Didache, chapter 14, verse 1, directs the people to gather on the Lord's Day and break bread, which is a common term for the Eucharist or communion. No Jewish synagogue would have allowed communion to take place in their premises. So what happened was that early Jewish Christians, while they could, would have gone to the synagogue on Saturday, worshiped with the Jews, and then on a different day, they would have come together with just Christians to celebrate communion. And according to the Didache, this happened on the Lord's Day, which we later find in books such as Gospel of Peter, Epistle of Barnabas, Apology, later in the second century, it's made explicit that the Lord's Day refers to Sunday. Now, the Lord's Day, the phrase itself, is also found in other contemporary writings as Revelation, such as Magnesians and the Gospel of Peter. What's interesting is that the term Sabbath appears only in the Gospels and the Acts, and there are singular mentions each in Colossians and Hebrews. So the Lord's Day implies a commemoration of something that is uniquely Christian, which is not shared with Judaism. So the evidence is pretty strong in favor of it being Sunday. But again, note that being in the Spirit on the Lord's Day does not necessarily mean a worship event. It was simply some kind of a ecstatic, trance-like experience that John was having at that time. Finally, it really doesn't matter for the interpretation of Revelation which day the Lord's Day happens to be. Going on, John describes the voice compared to a loud voice like a trumpet, and this may be an allusion back to the trumpet blast at Mount Sinai, calling the people to God. It invokes the imagery of the authority of God and of His revelation that was about to be given from Mount Sinai. The command to write is perhaps an allusion to Isaiah and Jeremiah, and again, it underscores the importance of that this is a revelation from God. Verses 12 through 16 describe what John saw. He first saw seven golden lampstands, and this once again goes back to Zechariah chapter 4, where it contains words, a lampstand of all gold. There were seven of them. So John is reappropriating a classic symbol of Judaism into Christianity, implying that Christianity is the true heir of Judaism. John sees a Son of Man, or the Son of Man. This is clearly an allusion to Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, which contains the phrase, one like a Son of Man. And we already saw this phrase used in the prologue section in verse 7. The long robe that this being wears is probably an allusion to the garments worn by priests. We find this in Exodus, in Zechariah, the apocryphal books of Wisdom of Solomon and the Wisdom of Ben Sirah. The golden sash or belt is found in Daniel chapter 10. Hair being white as wool or snow is an allusion to Daniel chapter 7. And once again, John is attempting to apply words that describe God in the Old Testament now to Jesus. In other words, John is trying to get his audience to understand once and for all that Jesus is God. Eyes like flame of fire is an allusion again to Daniel chapters 7 and 10. Feet as burnished bronze, Daniel chapter 10. Refined in a furnace, Daniel chapter 3. Voice like many waters, allusion to Daniel chapter 10, and noise of a multitude goes back to Ezekiel. A two-edged sword coming out of this being's mouth is perhaps an allusion to Isaiah chapter 49, where contains the phrase, mouth like a sharp sword. And this sharp sword is also a sharp sword that divides, is a New Testament vocabulary and phrase as well, and it's found, an instance is found in Hebrews chapter 4. Right hand, as we've noted before, is a symbol of power and protection, and we see that repeated in the Old Testament. Those examples include Exodus chapter 15, Deuteronomy 33, Psalm 16, and Psalm 17, 20, Isaiah chapter 41. The image of a being holding stars is perhaps an allusion to Job chapter 38, verses 31 and 32, where God is said to control the stars. A phrase like the sun shining is found in Judges chapter 5. And John is going to return to many of these phrases and images later in the book of Revelation. John's response is found in verses 17 through 20. As we've already noted, he falls down, one is dead. And this being reaches down to touch and says, "Fear not." This imagery comes straight out of Daniel chapter 10, where the same thing happens to Daniel. The first and last is an echo of the prologue, verse 8 of chapter 1. The Son of Man being described as the Living One is an allusion to Joshua chapter 3 and the apocryphal book of the Wisdom of Ben Sira. The phrase "died and alive" refers again to the death and resurrection of Jesus, which John already noted in verses 5 and 7. When it comes to Hades, the word Hades, it does not directly translate to hell. It is not a place of punishment, but rather it's the Greek equivalent to the Hebrew concept of Sheol, simply in the place of the dead. Now, the place where the Hebrews imagined the dead to be after they had gone. Simply means the grave. And we see that in Job, Psalms, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Hosea, and many other places in the Old Testament. We've already noted that the key, or the keys, refers to the power to unlock. And in this specific case, the power to unlock death and its consequences. The command to write was given at the very beginning of the book. It was also given at the beginning of this particular section in verse 11. And it forms what is known as an inclusio, or bookends, bracketing this whole section from verses 11 through 19. So we can see this as a unit. This verse 19 also contains the phrase, things that you have seen, those that are, and those that are to take place after this. Now, on first glance, it would seem like then he's talking about the present as well as the future, and many interpreters have concluded from that the book of Revelation is divided distinctly into two sections, those things that are happening during John's time, and then the second half of the book, wherever that division may occur, describes those things that haven't happened yet, but will take place. However, looking more closely at things, it's better to not make too much out of the change that's found in the verb tenses. This is actually an allusion back to Daniel chapter 2, and one of the verses there is verse 45, where Daniel writes, God has made known to the king what shall be after this. And from that phrase, it would seem that everything that follows in Daniel chapter 2 would be describing the future, but what actually happens is that Daniel describes things that have already taken place, those things that are taking place, as well as those things that are about to take place. And so, after this, what shall be after this includes both the past, the present, as well as the future. So when we read that, and as we've already seen, this introduction to the seven letters is full of allusions back to Daniel. We get the sense that the entire book of Revelation, the entire book, not just the first part, but the whole book, includes things about the past, present, and future. And therefore, we should be careful in making, or we should be careful not to make artificial divisions as to where the past ends, where the present ends, and where the future begins. Rather, we should attempt to see the past, present, and future in all that is read. Finally, Daniel describes God, his God, as God who reveals mysteries, and John continues that pattern. John is putting forth the proposal that the rest of the book continues God's pattern of revealing mysteries. Just as he did in the Old Testament, he's going to do it now for his people, his servants. So in summary of the introduction to the letter to the seven churches, why did John write? Well, he was told to write. He was commissioned by God. To whom did John write? He wrote specifically to the seven churches of Asia. They are his audience. Everything in the book of Revelation is directly applicable to them. John is writing about what happened, what was, what is, and what is to come. He's not making artificial divisions. He's writing in the scope of all history. Who commissioned John? Jesus did. And what does this passage reveal about Jesus? Well, one thing it reveals that he is certainly powerful. He holds dominion over everything from the heaven to the earth to the underworld. He is all powerful. Yet at the same time, in the imagery of Jesus touching John and saying, "Fear not," Jesus is close to each Christian. And a question here. Any significance and similarities between Hecate and John's description of Jesus? Well, to the Greeks, to the Gentiles, to the Gentile Christians, though that imagery would have been familiar. It would have, I think in some ways, it helps relate Jesus to them. Now, just as illustrations in contemporary times relating Jesus to something that we are objects and beings that we are familiar with can help us relate better, I think John was doing something similar. But to say that Jesus is Hecate would be wrong, but rather Jesus has similarities to Hecate or to Artemis, but Jesus is far greater. Once again, John keys in on Jesus' death and resurrection. They're important themes. Once again, John applies to Jesus language that is traditionally associated with God. Once again, emphasizing that Jesus is indeed God. Jesus walking among the lampstands, walking among the churches, shows that Jesus stands with the churches. He is close to each of the churches. He is close to every group of Christians. And finally, Jesus' right hand of power and protection is over each of the church as he walks among them. His power and protection is over each of the churches. The message for us today, taking all of that, is we can continue to be confident that Jesus is with us, that Jesus cares for us, that we can trust him. We do not have to fear him. We do not have to fear God, because Jesus is God, and Jesus tells us, fear not. He cares for us, he is with us, he is close to us, yet at the same time, he has all power. He has the power to watch over us and to protect us. This concludes session number 4 of Revelation Road Trip.